This is the second part of General Marshall's interview on November the 15th.
To repeat what I said at the end of the other reel, I wouldn't take any decorations after we got into the war, which led to a good many difficulties. And I've declined to take many since, because I wouldn't involve myself in getting the authority of Congress to approve it. I got one from Russia, I think on Harriman's insistence. I insisted I shouldn't get the decoration. And the night, the evening, almost the hour of the landing in Normandy, they presented me this decoration at the Russian embassy. Gromyko. I was much opposed to that. And this thing came up and came up. And I didn't want to be put in the position of taking any decoration like that while our men were fighting, particularly when they were in such devilish country. And the pressure would be very considerable at times. One or two put it over by boarding the decoration and coming up with it before I had any chance to control the thing. And I relieved two attachés because I found they were conniving, though they all had instructions to oppose any proposition to give me a decoration. There I had a particular reason because of Lend-Lease.
Mm-hmm.
And the country is pressing for Lend-Lease affairs. Then give me a decoration. That just wouldn't do at all. But I found these attachés would get a decoration with me. So they had a verbatim instruction for me in regard to the matter, and I found, as I recall, two that tried to evade it and get a decoration, and I relieved them.
Frank McCarthy said you told him once that if you got honorary degrees and decorations, he'd go to get thrown out.
Well, I depended on him to stop these things, too. You got you nowhere, you know. I don't know. I think I've declined between 20 and 30. I haven't got any from Norway or Sweden or Holland or Belgium. They tried and tried to do it, but I was out of the country when they made their presentations, and that congressional law permitting you to accept the decoration had lapsed, and they came to me, particularly Holland and Belgium, a number of times to try to get me to accept one, and I wouldn't do it. Well, however, show you what a part they played. They were after me to get some other decoration. I've forgotten what it was. It was quite a bit of pressure. And we were having a meeting of the U.S. Chiefs of Staff, Potsdam, I think. And Ley came by to make his departure for a holiday they had there, which the president was going away, and others were going various places. And we were going to stay and work with the Soviet chiefs of staff. And I told Ley, he was going to England, I said, now don't you accept any medal up there. With me, it would be very embarrassing. It wouldn't be with him at all, the way he was fixed. But I was just doing this as a joke. Well, Jack McCloy came in somewhere, and he saw Ley, and he said, they told him that I'd said Ley had gone to England to accept the decoration. And Ley has practically never spoken to me since.
Oh, really?
Perfectly furious. Well, if I really did say it, he had a right to be furious. And he took it up and discussed it before the chiefs of staff. Well, I couldn't, I just couldn't explain. I was, what I said was just because of his impeccable position, mm-hmm. I made this jocular reference. McCloy comes along and gets it as a statement. So Lay was, he and I broke right there.
I was there.
Had a very serious consequence. Then they were, I got involved in the decoration from Columbia University because I found that all the rest of the commanders were getting it the same day. I think even General Eisenhower, I'm not certain. I know the others were all there. I know Nimitz was there. I would have declined that, but that was afterwards when I was still going along trying not to take anything. I had to compromise on one or two things. I compromised on Harvard at the time of my Marshall Plan statement. They had invited me, and I had declined three or four times. And we decided suddenly that that was the date. We thought first, one about 2 or 3 weeks earlier, University of Wisconsin was the date. And then we went to the 15th of June, thinking Amherst would be the date. And then suddenly, the way things were unfolding in Europe, and affairs over here too, politically, we landed on this Harvard date. They had asked me, I think, three or four times, and I declined. So I telegraphed them, were they agreeable to still give me the thing, and that's the way we made the date.
Oh, I see.
And one or two other things in there. Amherst, I promised McCloy that I would take a degree from Amherst. And when I went up there, he drove about 30 miles to meet me, and he and the dean and took me to the dean's house, and all for this date, and he promised me that I wouldn't have to make a speech or anything. And the ceremonies were outdoors. When we came, we went down through the aisle between the students and mounted the stand. And I'd say previously we sat at the dean's house, and he was a, I think it was the dean, he was a classmate of McCloy's, and they had a great deal of persiflage there, and were amusing, and his wife served us scotch, and I had three scotches. I never drink scotch. In fact, I don't drink much of anything. But I sat there laughing with them, and I drank three scotches. And suddenly the time for the ceremony came up, and we went over and robed and went up there, and I found myself sitting in the front seat. I sat down on the programs, and the president sat next to me, and some kindly soul in rear of me handed me the program, and I opened the program up, and very impressive looking. There were only two speeches. There was one by the Secretary of State of the United States. I wasn't to make any speech at all. I was sitting there with three scotches aboard. That was the darnest dilemma I ever got into. I turned around and got McCoy's eye, and he just shriveled all up. They'd broken faith with him, too. The president was to talk, and I was to talk, and I was to talk first. Oh, my God, I thought my only hope is what I can think of while the fellow's making, what is the religious statement at the start?
The invocation.
Yeah, the implication. Yeah. Well, as a rule, that fellow tries to settle everything, you know.
Yeah.
Well, this one did it in one sense.
You were hoping for a long life.
For a long one. And I got up and I found out that there were 400 of this class were all veterans.
Oh.
It's quite unusual that they'd gotten into the first class. So I just proceeded to talk to the veterans. And apparently I made one of the best talks I've ever made with those three scotches before. They printed it and circulated all over the place. I never will forget my feelings. I couldn't duck. It was this formal thing. I had to be very careful what I said.
Yeah.
Secretary of State. Must be. I'm so damn mad at McCloy. Well, there was another thing I was going to say about that. I tell that because I had to accept a decoration there in order to oblige McCloy. And they took me down to Brown. And down to Brown is quite different. The president was a bachelor, and his engagement was announced that night. They had a Benedict's dinner there. I arrived doing the dinner at his house, and his daughter received me. And the former lady general staff officer who kept all the chiefs of staff records, Miss, what's her name? She was became a lieutenant colonel. And she ran all the records for the chiefs of staff. And incidentally, she knows an awful lot about all this thing. You ought to talk to her. She's over in CIA.
That's not Miss Mason.
I would have taken her all around the world with me, except King would have gone crazy if we had a woman on these things. But she knows a great deal about it, and she would brief me before the meetings. And Arnold heard this, and then Somerville, so she had to brief Arnold, and she had to brief Somerville. She would bring us up to date on all these various things, and particularly about the combined chiefs of staff. She was very, very well informed, and she handled all these records. I brought her in as a WAC, receptionist, without ever seeing her. I wanted to have some WAC near the office. And pretty soon they came to me and said, would I object to her briefing papers? They were getting pretty far behind. And then later they came to me, would I object if they made her a member of the general staff, because she was doing general staff work all day long, every day, and doing surpassingly well. And she has quite a leading spot over in the CIA. Just find out who the woman was that looked at all the records.
George will know.
Yes, he would know. Though he wasn't with me then.
Yeah, but he knows a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. He's met them at one time or another.
He might have known, because I was concerned with getting into the CIA and getting her back on a reserve status when she left her job up in Rhode Island.
But you were telling me about Brown when you went down there.
Well, his daughter, I hadn't had any dinner. About 9 o'clock, his daughter said something about, where did you eat dinner? Well, I said, I did eat in the plane. Well, she said, where'd you eat? I said, I had meat. Well, she said, I don't know, I think there's a thing in the house. And she came back and said, do you like ice cream? I said, I love it. And this woman, you see, this ex-WAC, who had married a doctor, came in not knowing I was there, but knowing I was coming, and thinking it was the next day, with the cake she'd make to prove that she could do something besides the general staff papers. She made a delicious cake with almost a liquid icing. So I just ate cake and ice cream. Well, this bird came in from his Benedict dinner. He was not exactly a surly person, but he wasn't a very charming person. And he met me and turned right away to his daughter. He said, I'd like some ice cream. And she said, isn't any? I'd eat it all up. He was sore as a foot. Well, when we got out on the stand the next day, Dulles' brother was there then. He got a degree too. He wanted to talk about his performance instantly in relation to the Italian treaty. He'd hardly let me get into the place before he cut loose of that. And just after the president made a talk, he turned to me and he says, anything you want to say? And I said, no. That was the end of that thing.
Well, you're glad to get off that.
Anything you want to say? I said, no. They were all trying to find out why I didn't say something.
You'd had the ice cream, though.
There wasn't any doubt about what he meant. He was still sore about the ice cream, but I think he was sore anyway.
I think the point you made a while ago, though, about these little asides is most important, because I tried to argue that in the introduction to my book on Schaaf, that if you read nothing but the record, you'll likely think that these people were always trying to dig traps and to mm-hmm. see if they could defeat their allies, when actually this is a natural outgrowth of irritation and all that. But you have to look at the broad points of agreement. Isn't that true?
I think I told you, didn't I, about Hull bringing me this paper from the planners when they opposed this thing of the British?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I got over there and found it was a quotation of ours.
Portal caught you on it. Portal caught you on it.
Yeah, see, the one did it. I didn't see why they were going about the thing. And Hull said, well, we think it's advisable. They were very suspicious of the British, and anything that seemed to involve that probably had a semi-political background, you see. Well, I know we were afraid about this supply thing of the Turks. We were just being hounded in every direction there. And the president would get into these things, you know, without realizing what it is doing to the makeup of the existing army.
I mean, it just sounded good to him.
Yeah, they wanted to give him something. God knows they'd appropriated enough money, you see, but he didn't realize on the money, you see. It takes a long time to... I became Secretary of Defense about the 20th of September in 50, and the money, $122 billion appropriation had become effective about a week before. And outside of food and pay and clothing, virtually nothing of that was delivered before the 1st of September. In fact, I'd ceased to be Secretary of Defense before that got through. I don't know anything about that shifting the thing to the Balkans.
Well, for some reason, in October and November of 43, you'll find in the planner's papers again and again this worry about the Russians going to shift. And General Morgan, who was over here at that time, wired back and said we may lose Overlord entirely because Mr. Roosevelt seems interested in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. And it must have just been a quick flare-up.
I think so. You always scared the death of Mr. Roosevelt on the Balkans. Apparently he was with us, but we couldn't bet on it at all. I don't recall about the pressure exerted by Dean's letter.
This is another one of those things that they read stuff into. It's the kind of letter that you wrote General Eisenhower later and said, talk tough to the Russians. But the impression that enemies of yours tried to give was that you were warned and paid no attention to it, you see.
Oh, well, it's like those things out in Hawaii and all the fellows. Air and all warning. Well, everybody, if I took those sort of things, I'd have been so involved in warnings, I would have done nothing anywhere.
That's right. Well, that's like what you said about the overcautiousness of staff members. They expect to see buggers all over the place, aren't they?
You've got to trust in the Lord and that they're conservative. You're the fellow that has to be unconservative. I'm as critical of a commander that is ultra-conservative, but it's quite essential that he gets a conservative staff. Maybe some of them off the record can suggest this or that. Now, I saw I saw numbers that had special ideas, that one fellow the whole artillery was after, condemning him. I had him in and let him expose his whole plot to me, and they were just practically excommunicating him. I had the air fellow in that was trying to advocate these things in France, you know.
Yes.
I let him come to me and go over the whole thing, and I sent him all over there to France so he could look at it. I saw all those people and then judged whether they had a real show or not. Anybody who opposes these and is pretty voluble about it, particularly if it begins to leak out, the staff procedure, the staff is very critical of. It's like when I went into the War Plans Division, I found the War Department staff was wholly so antagonistic to the air you couldn't get a hearing on anything. And things that I took up, though it wasn't my job, I was just War Plans, that I took up with General Embick and General Craig to have them do, and Craig would agree, but he had a hard time agreeing because I was new in a sense, and I was junior to all his assistant chiefs of staff, and they were all bitterly antagonistic to the Air Corps because they'd slipped into Congress there and gotten the thing. They were bitterly antagonistic to any large bombers, and even Embick, who was a very logical fellow, would sit there and tell me how ridiculous the whole thing was to think you could have a large bomber, where it could land, where it could do this and where it could do that. Of course, if you brought all that up, they'd just be screaming.
Yeah.
Heebie-jeebies now. And I had gotten the air fellows on the thing. But the prejudice is very deep. And when I went in as deputy chief of staff, damn if I found they hadn't done any of those things yet.
Yeah.
Now they've been complaining, and I don't know what they're doing, about the fact that they're losing the personnel in the Air Corps.
Mm.
And they're being bought up by all the private industry. Well, I found the Air Corps was just losing everybody. They'd had a course that took about a year. And a fellow graduated in the course, and then he'd be offered a large sum of money taken by one of the big air companies. And they wanted all sorts of things. But what I did was, I required that when the fellow took this course, he had to sign an agreement to re-enlist for 3 years.
I see.
Two or three, whatever it was, as he graduated. So he couldn't resign. And it wouldn't be purchasable. In other words, we trained the man. If the man wanted to take the training, he had to do this or we wouldn't give him the training. And I just stopped it right off the bat. But now they're talking about all kinds of elaborate things. You don't have to have any elaborate thing. You can stop it in a second.
Yeah.
Of course, but then the consuls say, well, you have no right to prevent a fellow from buying out.
You have a thing like that at BMI, don't you? That those people on scholarships have to give...
A year's teaching.
A year's teaching or something.
In the question
four of 13.
It says five here. Yes, it is four, yes. God, I can't. Is that corrected or not there?
Yeah, that's supposed to be four.
It was a five, wasn't it?
It was a five, yes.
No, this question didn't worry me very much about the Russians there. Stalin stated what he wanted, and he did it.
Actually, that's a general question as to your overall impression of Stalin. I put it here because it's the first time you saw him, wasn't it, at Tehran?
Yeah. He was a very six. I don't know whether he knew it or not, but he pressed for me all the time and made it quite a point. And I could take it or leave it, as whether it was just because he thought I was the man for it or he was trying to precipitate this second front. He was very insistent and took quite a part in there. He was insistent about the dates. He was insistent about the operation from southern France. He played quite a part in those things. Question 7, no, I don't recall any of that. I have a faint recollection, but I'm not even certain that I asked something about his... of the Chinese reactions. But I'm not even certain of that.
Then if you could give me a general description of your reaction to Stalin and what you thought about him.
I found the Generalissimo a very astute negotiator. He had a dry wit. He was agreeable. And in regard to me, he made sort of semi-affectionate gestures when we were in opposition. He'd stand with his hand on my shoulder. It is, he was arguing for an immediate second front, and he was explaining the way how to make a landing using the Volga River or one of those Russian rivers as his example of how you do it. We recognized that his great effort then was to get us to do these things. And he was turning the hose on Churchill all the time. And Mr. Roosevelt, in a sense, was helping him. He used to take a little delight in embarrassing Churchill. The Russians were very antagonistic to Rook. And at the birthday dinner, Stalin made some very acid but amusing remarks about Rook when he came to Moscow, which Rook endeavored to reply to. Stalin was very free in his probing Churchill and did not follow this at all, this course at all, with Mr. Roosevelt. Harry Hopkins, in his speech at the dinner, was very amusing.
Someone got it. Someone's there. Huh? Someone got it.
And I would say pungent. But his talk was largely addressed to Mr. Churchill. And he was very amusing and very clever in his comments about the convenience of an unwritten constitution. And described the English procedure, making use of that to their own advantage. Throughout all of this, Stalin was very clever. I'm going to turn it off. I'm going to the bathroom.
All right.
when it came to the exact discussion of the military phases, Stalin was reasonably precise, and as later evidenced, very sincere, because he carried out his agreements to the day. I'm referring now to the matter of moving his armies to Manchuria. I have, in contrast to this, Stalin in the political field, where I met him as Secretary of State in Moscow in 1947. There, he was completely evasive and would receive the most almost brutal assaults as I felt I was making, with unchanging countenance, and you might say a trifling reference to later on. I talked to him at one stretch for almost an hour. And in the effort to get him to admit what was the purpose of deliberately antagonizing the United States when they had stood in very high regard at the end of the war, more so than the British, as a matter of fact, I proceeded to recite all the things they had done to arouse antagonism in the citizens of the United States, and certainly of its officials, and sought from him some reply as to the explanation. At that time, I was hoping to succeed in getting their agreement to the Austrian Treaty, which was practically complete at the time, and very much in the form that it was finally adopted. As nearly as I can recall, though I think this is a matter of record, his reply to most of this was, well, these are just the opening skirmishes. You have to get by, go through that phase first. But my impression was I was getting nowhere. At dinner, where he and I sat together, he was very agreeable and very informative. Matter of fact, I found Molotov the same in a dinner table conversation. Very interesting in his account of his own banishments from Russia. But the attitude completely changed the minute of his business. So in effect, Stalin impressed me as a very clever negotiator, a man who could lighten the serious part of the affair with rather dry retorts, the kind he turned on Churchill. And when it got into the field that he didn't intend to do business with you, the political field, you got absolutely nowhere.
Well, did you find him lacking in social graces or anything like that?
He was very nice in those things.
In other words, you didn't get the impression he was an illiterate peasant who had risen to power.
I was rather surprised to find that seemingly none of our people had read his early history. And I thought that was quite essential when you're dealing with a fellow that had done the things he did in the early days to get money for the Communist Party.
He just highwayed them.
Oh, yes. Lost banks, everything else.
Yeah.
What number am I on, do you know?
together has the bulk of your story. And then later Sherwood wrote you about your appointment of Eisenhower as Supreme Commander. And he says that you wrote him some of this material. And all I'm asking here is there anything you can think of that you did not cover in those two accounts?
I don't remember.
It's
I can tell you very briefly.
All right, sir. I think it'd be valuable just to have it on the tape.
I was determined that I should not embarrass the president one way or the other, that he must be able to deal in this matter with a perfectly free hand for whatever he felt were the best interests in the matter. Well, of course, I was probed from many quarters, and I wouldn't express myself on any of them. And the thing never came to a head in any way until Hopkins came to me at Cairo and told me that the president was very much concerned because he felt he had to make a decision. The decision apparently had been conclusive at Quebec. But it had all come up again and been stirred around politically over here in this country, or in the press, rather. So I went to see the president, I think after luncheon, at his villa in Cairo. And as I recall, he asked me, after a great deal of beating around the bush, just what I wanted to do. Evidently, it was left up to me. Well, having in mind all this business that had occurred in Washington and what Hopkins had told me, I just repeated again, in this convincing language that I could get, that I want him to feel free to act in whatever way he felt was to the best interests of the country and to his satisfaction, and not in any way to consider my feelings. I would cheerfully go whatever way he wanted me to go. And I didn't express any desire one way or the other. And then he accepted that as an evident stop running.
It stopped registering. Just see if catches across there. Just speaking to it. It's all right, man.
Can you hear me there?
Yeah, it's all right. It sometimes just doesn't register.
What I was in the middle of a sentence. And then he evidently assumed that concluded the affair and that I would not command in Europe. Because he said, well, he said, I didn't feel that I could sleep at ease if you were out of Washington. I might say in regard to this that there was a great deal written and said, one way or another, a lot of it just silly. One time, notably led by a newspaper publisher in Tucson, who was supposed to have intimate contacts, who had known General Pershing intimately when he was sick out there, forgotten what it was I was going to say.
You said that there was a lot of talk in the paper,
yeah,
led by this man.
That the British were trying to kick me upstairs and get me out of the way from opposing them on the Chiefs of Staff affair. That was not true at all. That was not true. That was absurd. Matter of fact, Churchill, picking up the president's hesitation in appointing me, in confirming my appointment, had told Brooke he should have it. So Churchill was very much embarrassed in transferring it to Eisenhower. I was unaware of the fact that the Chiefs of Staff had gone to see the president, opposing my transfer. I was unaware of the fact at the time that General Pershing had made a special written appeal to the president not to move me out of Washington. These various factors, of course, aroused Mr. Roosevelt to a reconsideration of the decision that had already been made. But I was utterly sincere in the desire to avoid what had occurred so much in other wars, the embarrassment of the feelings of the individual rather than the good of the country. Mr. Roosevelt gives very good expression of his feelings in regard to me in a very generous attitude in replying to General Pershing's letter. But most of this stuff was whipped up for publication purposes without any sound basis.
Well, they actually at one time said they were trying to get you out of the way so that Somerville could have your job.
Yes, sir,
for politics, so they re-elect Roosevelt in 44.
Perfectly ridiculous.
But some of the same people that said that you were in the way of Roosevelt's political ambitions, then 4 or 5 years later said you were playing his game for him.
Well, of course, they're not consistent, are they? As a matter of fact, I had a letter less than a year ago from Justice up there that's a vice president?
No, but he was mentioned for vice president, Douglas. Justice Douglas.
Well, I guess it's Justice Douglas. I got this letter, and it'll be up in, maybe Ms. Marshall took it, I don't know, but I'll ask her. Otherwise, Frank McCarthy will have it up there. Wrote and told me that his lips had been sealed. But the president had told him, now, which campaign it was, whether it was the 43 campaign or the one before that, that he rather intended to put me up for president. Now, where are we now?
We're talking about that business of your conversation with Roosevelt over your appointment.
Well, that was the end of it.
And that's the end of that. But now these others are pretty much the same thing. Number 10, you've answered.
Number 9, I had no idea of anybody else.
And number 11, I just stuck that in because I thought it would interest you.
10, he had never made any promise.
Number 11 is just something I stuck in there because you may have never heard it.
Well, I don't think it would have. Matter of fact, I came pretty near blowing off out of turn as it was. I went up, I called on him at his headquarters up in Holland, I guess it was. And he was criticizing the fact that he'd been relieved from command from the active command, as he called it, and things had gone to pot with the Battle of the Bulge and all since then. And I was under terrific urge to whittle him down. And then I thought, now, this is Eisenhower's business, not mine, and I better not meddle. Though it is very hard for me to restrain myself because I didn't think there was any logic in what he said. But overwhelming egotism.
Oh, Eisenhower is one of the few people, I think, who could have put up with him and got work out of him. He got a great
deal.
Well,
he never really came to see Eisenhower once.
No. Treated him like he was an underling. Treated him like he was a subordinate.
Yeah, deliberately. Then when Eisenhower put him on that bonus thing, he turned around to get public opinion to back him in it. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Churchill and Alexander, prior to the Malta meeting, I think, wanted to put Alexander in the position of ground commander of the whole thing, all in criticism of Eisenhower's handling of the Bulge. And they approached me on the subject.
You gave them a rough time on that, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I was pretty politic.
Please.
I was very flat on the thing. That was hardly a time to be. See, they'd worked up a great feeling because it is a complete surprise, you see, and they don't forgive commanders for surprises. It was an English G2 that let him down. I'm worried about this thing. I'd just gone along that front, just what happened, all the way up. I went to every division on the front we had all the way up. And then they ended up calling on Monty. We talked over this long, 22 kilometers, I think, or maybe 52, I've forgotten. With one division in it.
Is it 52?
52, was it? And I knew that they had moved one particular division from 2 or 3 months of rest, which was now over strength, which is quite unusual for German divisions of that day, across the Rhine. But the conclusion of our intelligence was that it was over there to throw back any attack to cross the, was the Ruhr River?
Yes.
The Ruhr River. Bradley felt that we could cross the thing. He didn't say without difficulty, but he didn't have any seeming doubts. I didn't see how I was going to do it myself. And here were these rested and overstrength divisions, the meeting. Actually, the division was over there for the Battle of the Bulge.
That's one of the few things that I felt that General Bradley may have read past events into it. He later said he knew there was a risk, but he took a calculated risk. But I don't believe he ever thought it was as serious as it was.
I don't think so either. I think they got soaked. I can't make any comment about myself in this thing at all.
No, it's hard to. I mean, General Eisenhower, after all, did a fine job, and you were here to...
He was completely loyal.
And you were here to hold up his hands and...
I think this. I don't think he appreciates, not that he's ever depreciated, but I don't think he appreciates the half of what I did to hold his hand in respect to Congress and all. The things that I did, innumerable things I did, particularly the dinners I would give at the Alibi Club to the leaders in Congress and bring in this person, that person. I was all the time building up his position so that he could, they could resist any attacks which would come with misfortune. Senator, what's his name from Texas? He just iterated and iterated about the Battle of the Bulge. And
Connolly, he can be awful rough.
I'll take you in on one thing I was rather proud of. I told you first about when I left for Brazil on that mission. Craig wanted to know what he could do for me, and I wanted to see if this one sentence was put in the appropriation back about the engineers. In accordance with the regulations undertaking all the construction of fortifications, and they said an airfield wasn't a fortification. Well, I said, you're just insisting it's got to have a parapet. That's nonsense. It is a fortification. any event, you could call it a fortification. Well, he didn't do a damn thing about it, and it got into law, and I had this dreadful time, and that's where Somerville comes into the play. What the devil was I talking about? I was leading up to it.
If you called in Congress, members of Congress,
oh, yes. I'd gotten back, and another thing I wanted to do was to get the law passed, which they'd had fooling around with a long time, to have lieutenant generals to command core areas. It was very important, because out in Chicago, for example, they'd had, I think, 3 commanders in less than a year. Well, it'd take a man almost a year to come to know the adjutant generals and the National Guard and all those things you had to deal with. It wasn't a question of commanding these little regular troops of driblets around. And you had to take the senior fellow. I wanted to be able to put your finger on the man you wanted, and he would work like the devil. Instead of being interested in 2 cars and his wife's bathroom she wanted at the end of his career, he'd be working for that particular job. I'm not exaggerating about that car business and bathroom business, that wives would be right on their bikes and wasn't anything else happening, and they didn't have the time to learn their core areas. And that was the situation. As I say, I wanted to touch the fella, and he was, his performance, his rank depended on his performance, because he lost the rank the minute he was relieved from that command. And Craig said he would do something about that, and he didn't do anything about it. So I'd only been back 3 days when I announced that I was going up on the hill to see Senator, damn it, I keep forgetting his name.
Connally.
Who had thrown out the consideration of this thing by opposing it in the, either on the floor or in the committee, I've forgotten which. It was being handled by the old senator that brought in the Volstead Act, Shepard. And he was the senior fellow. And Connally, because it's been pushed aside. And the other man was from Utah, who was the man that they used to object to everything. He couldn't have those things, we have to have unanimous consent. He just objected right off the bat. Well, so I was going up there, and they came right in and told me right away, don't you do that. If you do that, you're lost. You can't do that. Well, I said, my God, you certainly can't do it sitting here. And I went on up there. My first appointment was with Senator Connally. And I decided that I would enumerate all the objections that I thought he would make, and then I would proceed to destroy them. Well, he beat me to it, because he told me to sit down, I sat down, and he began talking before he sat down. And he just tore the army to ribbons. And what he was attacking, of course, in particular, were all these generals around Washington who were head of bureaus and all that, and the assistant chiefs, and no troops and a lot of generals, which you see around Washington, you see. And they were very prominent in those days. And I just puzzled my head on what in the world I was going to say, because he was just tearing the whole thing down, and he was a very potent and powerful senator. And I was trying to figure this thing out all the time he was talking. It was getting worse and worse, and I couldn't get any line of departure. And he ended up by saying, he said, "And young man," I said, "Thank you for that compliment, Senator. And young man, you don't appreciate the historical significance of the great lieutenant general." Well, oh boy, you walked right into my lap that time. And so the minute he stopped talking, I said, "Well, Senator, what state are you from?" Well, he was just infuriated that I should ask him what state he was from. Well, he said, "I'm from Texas." Well, I said, "I thought you were." Well, he said, "Why did you ask me that?" Well, I said, the Southern Army, and Jackson and Longstreet and those people had lieutenant generals right from the start, and Lee was a full general, and Bragg was a full general, and they had a pretty successful army. At least I think as a Texan you'd agree with that. You just grunted. Well, I said, "I asked you that because finally Lincoln made Grant a lieutenant general, and from that instant on they just licked the Confederates right and left." "Well," he said, "I don't know about this thing of this great." Well, I said, "Senator, you have such power." He said, "Well, I will not act." Well, I said, "You've already acted. With your prestige, you've opposed the thing." And what I'm asking you to do is undo what you've done. And I think it's quite essential. And I told him two or three of the things that I was interested in. Then I went to the fellow from Utah. I got to state my case first. Well, he said, how about? He said, how about that arsenal out in Utah? He treated me right off the bat. Well, that settled in about 10 minutes. I agreed to the damn arsenal and what it was or anything else. But it was a logical storage place, you know, for that area. And his was just right off the bat. When they said I didn't know anything about the workings of democracy politically, I know so damn much more than the average fellow. But what's his name never stopped talking about that lieutenant generalship. After I was Secretary of State, he still talked about it and still thought it was unconstitutional.
I heard him make a speech opposing the grade of permanent general, in which he said, but you'd taught him some caution. He said, the greatest general that ever lived was beaten by a lieutenant general. You see, he didn't. He stayed off that Southern stuff.
Well, he never dropped it. And he seemed to be convinced that it was unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And he took that long list that we were making at that time, and they made too many of them. They have too many of them now. And it just stuck in his mind. He was licked. But I said, Senator, I'm sorry about this, because you were utterly sincere in opposing this thing, and it's unconstitutional. I just don't see it at all. I said, it's almost as bad as the president, who took such violent objection to a brigadier general who only cost $25 a month and a 35-cent flag. I used to hit Mr. Roosevelt with that. If he was on a certain job, it didn't cost him anything.
Yeah.
But if he was on a post, I don't know which was, vice versa or whatnot, it was $25 a month. When I was made a brigadier general, that was my promptable pay. But I was on a post, and I don't think I got the 25.
That was 35 cents.
I used to take after Mr. Roosevelt on that. He would get so damn mad at me. I would feel out on these things till I get some particular thing. Yeah. But my closest shave was with Connolly, and not till he said that I didn't understand the historical significance of the great lieutenant general that I nailed him. And he admitted I had him, but he never admitted that the thing was constitutional.
The man from Utah, was that Smoot?